dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence we are always delighted to tap, his insights, his understanding, his mastery of so many of the topics of great importance to our time, is the president and CEO of the Center for Security Policy. He is Fred Flights. You all know him. He is a career intelligence professional who has served our country in a number of different important capacities, both in the intelligence community, notably at the Central Intelligence Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency, but also in overseeing that community as a professional staff member of the House Intelligence Committee. He has served in addition as a chief of staff to Ambassador John Bolton, first at the State Department and during his tenure as the National Security Advisor to President Trump. He is a very considerable contributor to the public policy debate through his writings in any number of places, his appearances at Fox, and not infrequently, his presiding over important panel discussions, like one that, well, by the time this program airs, will have happened, but we're going to talk about it in prospect, concerning anti-Semitism and the threat that it really poses to our own security, as well as that of Jews and, of course, Israel. Fred Flights, welcome back. It's good to have you, sir, as always.
Hey, Frank. Good to be here.
So tell us about this panel. Who's going to be participating, and what do you anticipate will come of it?
Well, it's really a major event for the center. The title is Anti-Semitism, Defending Israel and the Trump Administration. We have an all-star panel of experts, Morgan Klein, president of Zionist Organization of America, Rabbi Ezekiel Moskowitz, who's founder and CEO of MBLA International, Jim Carafano of the Heritage Foundation, and Matthew Brodsky, who's a geopolitical analyst with the Gold Institute for International Strategy. And what we're going to be looking at, Frank, is how a surge in anti-Semitism on the left in coordination with Islamists is not just a dire threat to religious liberty. It's a threat to American and international security, because this is an effort to destroy the state of Israel and to rob it of support from the American people. And we're going to make the case, this is not just on the extreme. This is coming into the mainstream. It's being tolerated by journalists and politicians and the media and members of Congress. It has entered the U.S. Congress, and we need to speak out on this. We need to speak out on what is at risk here. I'll tell you right now, I know most members of the Democratic Party in Congress are pro-Israel, and they support the Jewish people. But their party is moving in another direction, and I think this is a dire threat for national security and for international security.
Yeah, I do too, Fred. This isn't a partisan matter. It just happens that the Democrats increasingly are subject to pressure, which they seem less and less able or even willing, perhaps, to resist from most notably Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, the prominent Muslim radicals, really, in the House of Representatives. But from other sources as well. And I'm very pleased that you're having Mort Klein on. I'm a big fan of his. He was a recipient of our Keeper of the Flame Award at the Center for Security Policy, as you know. And he's also been pointing out of late, in particular, the degree to which some of the impetus behind this anti-Semitism is coming from prominent figures in the Muslim clergy in the United States. And I think this is an important topic as well. I hope you'll be discussing it a bit. But Fred, as you look at this as a phenomenon and you look at the extent to which there seems to be, less and less resistance to it in certain circles, not just in the Democratic Party, but in the press, in the public at large, I'm afraid. To what extent do you see some of the same leading indicators as what we've watched playing out in Europe in recent years?
I'm worried that the Democratic Party is going the way of the Labour Party in the UK, which has been accused of blatant anti-Semitism. And let me give you an example. Ilhan Omar made some reprehensible anti-Semitic remarks a few months ago. You may remember them. I'm not going to repeat them on the air. And Nancy Pelosi, the speaker, was unable to pass a resolution condemning Omar or her remarks, or a resolution just condemning anti-Semitism. She was able to pass a resolution, but it had to be filled with a laundry list of other bigotries to condemn, including Islamophobia. So think about it. Congresswoman Omar insults a Jewish people, and the House passes a resolution condemning Islamophobia. Go figure.
Right. Well, I think it's not hard to figure. This is appeasement for long. Listen, Fred, one other topic I wanted to hit with you before we have to let you go is Iran. Of course, you have been one of the preeminent authorities in our country on Iran for quite some time. And I wanted to just ask you, what is up with Britain, France, and Germany now finally coming around and joining President Trump's administration in identifying Iran as the source of this, Mike Pompeo, our Secretary of State, called it this act of war against Saudi Arabia involving this attack on the Abqaiq oil facility. And yet they seem intent on continuing to prop up to try to breathe life into this failed joint comprehensive plan of action with Iran. What do you make of what they're saying and doing, and what should be our response?
Well, Frank, when a rogue state fires cruise missiles at another state, it's hard to contend for long that that wasn't an act of war. I think the Europeans had no choice but to admit that this is what happened and to name Iran as the perpetrator. I think the Europeans also realized that the nuclear deal is dead, and they're now talking about finding ways to extend the deal and include missiles and Iran's sponsorship of terrorism, but they still want to stay in the deal. I got to tell you, I'm not convinced they're backing out of this agreement. I think that the elites are never going to surrender this deal because they're going to stick to this thing that Barack Obama negotiated. They refused to give President Trump a win. They refused to admit that this agreement was a fraud that they signed on to. But they have to admit that Iran's behavior is so awful and the security situation in the Persian Gulf has deteriorated to such an extent. They have to do something, but I'm skeptical.
Well, I'm skeptical, too, and I have the feeling that the net effect of this is likely to be whether they can do something actually to prop up this agreement or not, to continue to embolden the Iranians. How serious do you think it is that we're going to see, is the prospect that we're going to see still more attacks from this regime, as they have to this point at least gotten away with it?
Well, look, I understand that President Trump is being careful about using military force. I think he wonders what happens after we attack Iran, or what happens after the Saudis attack Iran. I think the Saudis have to be in the lead if there is military action in response to the attack on the Saudi oil fields. But frankly, if there is not some type of robust response, I think we will embolden Iran to launch many more attacks like this.
Well, we'll be following this closely, as will you, Fred Flights. Thank you very much for your time today and your leadership at the Center for Security Policy. Good luck with the panel. We'll look forward very much to hearing how it goes and what recommendations you all advance. Come back to us next week, if you would. Next up, we will speak with Judge Jeanine Pirot. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and it is the greatest of pleasure. I say we are back with Judge Jeanine. Jeanine Pirot, of course, is known by that stage name for her outstanding program at Fox News. Among other things, she is also an extraordinarily accomplished author, most recently of a brand new bestseller, Naturally. It is entitled Radicals, Resistance, and Revenge, The Left's Plot to Remake America. She has a number of others to her credit. We'll try to touch on those as well. But first, Judge Jeanine, it is so good to have you with us. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio.
It's always great to talk to you, Frank. I was looking forward to this also.
Well, terrific. Well, I wanted to visit with you first and foremost, of course, about the book and the nature of the plot that you have uncovered that the left is engaged in, its object, and who's behind it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The plot is pretty much out, open, and visible to anyone who cares to kind of analyze what's going on. You know, when I wrote Liars, Leakers, and Liberals, Frank, it was really about the corruption at the upper level of the FBI and the DOJ and the attempt to frame and overthrow a sitting president. And then I stepped back and I realized that there are other plots. And the one that comes to mind first is the First Amendment and the efforts by the left to pretty much squelch the free speech rights of people on the right by accusing us of being everything from a racist to a xenophobe or whatever phobe they can come up with that day.
Islamophobes, yes, I'm familiar with all of them, having been called them that as you have.
I know you are, Frank. And then we go, to Deborah Messing in Hollywood, where she wants to out anyone who supports President Trump, hoping that they'll never work in this town again. You know, McCarthyism in 2019. And, you know, then you've got, we can't speak at universities, colleges, obviously. And then Antifa comes in and they beat us down while police are told to stand down themselves by liberal mayors and chief executives. And, you know, we're taken off of Facebook, Twitter, et cetera. But then the thing that concerns me most, given my background as a prosecutor and a judge, is the denial of the presumption of innocence to anyone. I talk about Brett Kavanaugh when he first was nominated to the Supreme Court. And then, you know, last week, the plot continued with everyone wanting to impeach Brett Kavanaugh when there was no victim. I mean, the woman says she has no idea what's going on, what they're talking about. Her friends say she doesn't know what they're talking about. And the person who brought the complaint was a Clinton-connected lawyer. And so then all 20 Democrat candidates for president in that clown car that I write about in the book, they all want Brett Kavanaugh impeached. Forget that there's no presumption of innocence. Forget that there's no victim. There's no complainant. Let's just impeach him. Well, when the New York Times then says, oh, you know, sorry, then the squad member, Presley, whoever she is, comes out and says, well, I don't care. There are too many accusations. Impeach him. It's amazing. Hirono lunacy of, you know, all women need to be believed and men should just shut up.
Verdict first, trial after, as they say. And now, Judge, you were, of course, referring to a story that was put out by the New York Times before they apologized. It was put out, front page story, about Kavanaugh, these unfounded allegations. They had to retract them. But talk about the role of the press in this plot against both Donald Trump and really our country.
Well, the press is nothing more. The mainstream media is nothing more than the bully pulpit for the left. And, I didn't want to believe it, Frank. I did not want to believe it. But then I kept seeing it over and over where, you know, things, anything that was anti-Trump, like 90%, 98% of the coverage of Trump was negative. No honeymoon period, nothing. And then anything when Mueller comes out and says there's no collusion after Jim Comey, the one guy I accuse of basically fracturing this country for over 2 years, is outed as a liar and a leaker. And then no one wants to talk about there's no Russian collusion. There's none. There's never has been. It's a made up thing.
But they're still intent on impeaching him for it. Nonetheless, House Judiciary Committee.
Right. All of that. Nadler has lost his mind. Nadler, look, the guy never liked Donald Trump. He never did. He never will. And he looked like a fool with Corey Lewandowski as a first witness in an impeachment hearing from which he got nothing. It's really pathetic.
We're speaking with Judge Jeanine Pirot, the author most recently of Radicals, Resistance, and Revenge, The Left's Plot to Remake America. Now, when you talk about plots, invariably you get accused, as I again have been, of being a conspiracy theorist. And I just wanted you to respond to a comment by our mutual friend Andy McCarthy, who said he learned it in Rudy Giuliani's Southern District of New York Assistant U.S. Attorney's Office. And he said that they had an adage in the office, every conspiracy begins with a conspiracy theory. You've tried a lot of cases, including a lot of conspiracies over the years. differentiate, if you would, between what you've identified here in your book as a plot and this notion that, you know, just people are wildly alleging conspiracy plots and theories here, there, and yon.
Well, you know, I think that the evidence is overwhelming, and that's why I wrote the book. And there are 30 pages of footnotes. And look, I was law review. I always hated footnotes. But I figured that if you're going to be, you know, if you're going to be arguing, disagreeing with someone, at least have the facts behind them. Look, it's out there in the open. When 20 people line up of Democrats and say they want, you know, Medicare for all, and that, you know, what they're interested in is socialism, although Elizabeth Warren is someone who hides it under the term of capitalism, which I can talk about in a little bit. But none of this is under. See, everyone expects that a plot is something that's secret. It's not secret. It's out there in the open.
It is now.
Yeah, it is out. Joe Biden himself said, you know, I said I was going to withhold $1 billion if they didn't get rid of the prosecutor investigating his son. And in the Ukraine, his son had no experience in energy, oil, or anything else. And I mean, it was right out there in the open. And every one of those Democrats in the clown car running for president, you know, everyone in 2016, when Bernie Sanders said, I'm a socialist, Democrat socialist, everyone went, oh no, socialism. Well, here we are 3 years later. And it's like, yeah, we support it. We want the Green New Deal. Yeah, bring it on. And all you rich, you pay for everything. And let's bring in the illegals and let's give them driver's licenses and let them vote. And then, you know, we'll get rid of the Electoral College. Everything is upside down. The presumption of innocence, due process, free speech, all that. Look, all you have to do is look at what's going on in America today. We are upside down.
And this is part and parcel of what is the object, remaking America along the lines of what? A socialist or even totalitarian system? I mean, it's certainly the antithesis of our constitutional republic. But how would you characterize, Judge Jeanine, what the end state these folks seek is?
Well, what they seek is power, ultimately, Frank. It's all about power. You bring in illegals and they can vote and they're going to vote Democrat. You shut down the Republicans and then whether it's a university or anywhere, and you make everything they say so politically correct that they're afraid to say it. And then what you do is you get everyone to start thinking along their lines. You brainwash kids in school, kids in kindergarten.
Climate change, as an example.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just overwhelming. And sooner or later, it's all about power. They don't care. You know, Bernie Sanders said Venezuela was a great example of socialism, and it was on his Senate website. I have this in the book, and then he just took it down now that they're eating zoo animals and women are giving birth on the side of the road.
Yeah, it's an unmitigated disaster, of course, and is likely to become even worse if it is allowed to persist. Judge, I did want to ask you about one other thing. In addition to your books, and you mentioned Liars and Leakers, of course, we've been talking about Radicals, Resistance, and Revenge. You have used the platform of Justice with Judge Jeanine as a tremendous educational tool. And I want to thank you. I've appeared on it a couple of times myself. But so many of the issues of our day have gotten your close scrutiny. And there's one that I particularly want to thank you for, because I know that it's not something that other people ever talk about. And yet you've appreciated that it is absolutely central to our survival as a nation. And that's before everybody finishes remaking us. If the electric grid of the United States goes down, we're done. And I just would invite you in the remaining minute or two we have to talk a little bit about the importance of this issue to you, and I think to your listeners, of whom, fortunately, there are a great many of us.
Well, first of all, Frank, I want to thank you for really opening my eyes to the issue. And then, of course, I started talking about it about, I'd say, 5 years ago with the electric grid and the possibility of it going down and the nightmare that it would cause all of us who are so confident. And, you know, Americans, you know, are not the kind of people who would be able to rely on growing their own food and, you know, surviving without all of the accoutrements that we have. But I think what America does not what America doesn't realize is that we have a balkanized grid system, and attacks on the grid have occurred.
San Jose.
And, you know, the FBI said it was just a couple of schmucks shooting off a gun when it was clearly a very precise military operation where they took down the tried to take down the grid system there. The bottom line is this: unless Americans realize the dangers that are incumbent upon our grid system going down, whether it's by an electromagnetic pulse or whether it's by some kind of cyber threat, you know, then nothing is going to be fixed, because, you know, inertia is the method of the day in Washington, D.C.
This is what we appreciate so much about you, Judge Jeanine, and thank you for your time today. Come back to us soon, if you would, Judge Jeanine. It was great talking with you.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. As always, it's great to have with us Gordon Chang, one of the country's preeminent authorities on, well, what's happening in Asia, and most especially the implications of developments in China for our vital interests, national security, as well as economic. Gordon recently participated in a fact-finding mission to Hong Kong, conducted in his capacity as a member of the board of the American Conservative Union, a terrific organization led by Matt Schlapp, its chairman, and Dan Schneider, its executive director, two great Americans as well. I'm anxious to catch up with him, as he has been following closely developments in Hong Kong, and we rely on his assessments, both those he provides us here at Secure Freedom Radio and, of course, in the Daily Beast and National Review and other outlets, National Interest, as well as, of course, his three terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea. Gordon, welcome back. Good to have you as always.
Oh, thank you so much, Frank.
Let's start with that trip to Hong Kong, Gordon. You were in good company, and I know meeting with lots of folks on the ground there who were involved in these protests. What facts did you find?
I think the most important thing is we saw the demonstrators. Lydia and I, my wife, went to one demonstration at the Mong Kok police station because it's very close to where Lydia grew up. And so we know that area very well. And there are a couple things that came through. The most important, though, was the humanity of the demonstrators. These were the young kids dressed in black and in riot gear confronting the police. Yet, what I saw was the determination, grit, and the absolute belief that they had to defend their own home. And also, Frank, what was interesting was someone from Guangdong province inside China came down to support the demonstrators. And I thought that was significant because this shows the possibility of contagion, that these Hong Kong protests will spread into mainland China itself. So right now, we're seeing a society in revolt against not only its local leaders, who are basically stooges for Beijing, but also for China itself. And this is an important moment, I believe, in the fight for freedom around the world, because Hong Kong is the front line for freedom. And it's not just those people in Hong Kong. It's our freedoms as well, because we do have a common foe. And that foe, of course, is Beijing.
Yeah. Gordon, one of the things that's been operating for some time now is clearly the concern the Chinese have that this may spread to the mainland as well. And yet their determination to snuff these protests has been, it appears, put off by the fact that they're about to celebrate on the 1st of October the 70th anniversary of the People's Republic of China being founded. Do you anticipate that once those celebrations are behind Xi Jinping, he will turn to ruthlessly cracking down on what's an uprising, a revolution, if you will, in Hong Kong?
That's always a possibility, Frank. But I think that there's something else that's deterring Xi Jinping and the other Chinese leaders. A lot of people say that this would be a Tiananmen. I actually don't think that it would be. And the reason is Tiananmen was a one-way slaughter in 1989. You had wide open Beijing tanks and armored personnel carriers that were killing almost at will.
Unarmed, unorganized opposition in the square, right?
And also, more importantly, in the Western approaches to Tiananmen Square, where the PLA confronted ordinary citizens, or maybe I should say the other way around, and people, that was where there was the greatest loss of life, as people threw rocks and others and other objects at armor. Hong Kong is going to be entirely different. It's an urban landscape. You've got tall buildings, narrow streets and alleys. You've got a population which is prepared for what's going on because people have talked about this. And there in Hong Kong, you've got people like in Beijing in 1989 who are prepared to give their lives to save their homes. So there will be high casualties, Frank, but there'll be high casualties on both sides. And I think that Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, does not want his first war to take years, maybe decades, result in high losses, and also end up in a loss for China.
And there is the possibility, though it can't be stated with certitude, unfortunately, that the United States and other nations would hold the Chinese to account for what they do this time, as opposed to basically giving them a pass, getting back to business as usual, in the person of Brent Scowcroft, specifically in the Tiananmen aftermath, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think that George H.W. Bush and Brent Scowcroft should be severely criticized for craven diplomacy. We had an opportunity to end communism in China. Instead, we chose to support Beijing. This was the second great rescue of Chinese communism by an American president. This is a debacle. President Trump is not going to rescue the Chinese. And also just the American public would not stand for it, because now across the American political spectrum, there's a view that China is a threat to the United States and it is a malign actor. So this reaction would be very different. And I think although the president hasn't spoken in Reagan-esque terms about Hong Kong, quite the opposite, nonetheless, I believe that there has been intensive behind-the-scenes diplomacy between Washington and Beijing. And Chinese leaders know that this time they would pay a high diplomatic price. But I also believe that it's the thought of big casualties for their troops, for their forces, that will be the primary deterrent.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, as they say, Gordon. And one of the other indicators that the president is taking this China threat seriously, I think, is the elevation of the man who has been sort of the desk officer, if you will, at the National Security Council, Matthew Pottinger, to become the deputy national security advisor under O'Brien. I take this as a very positive sign for those of us on the Committee on the Present Danger, China, and like you, Gordon, who are deeply, deeply concerned about the Chinese threat. Do you?
When I heard the announcement that Matt Pottinger would be the Deputy National Security Advisor, I thought that was great for Matt, of course, but also a great day for America and a very bad day for America's foes, especially China.
Amen. We'll be hopefully both monitoring closely what Matt is able to do and supporting him at the Committee on the Present Danger, China, and beyond. Gordon, let me turn to one other very important issue in your portfolio. I understand you're going to follow your ACU visit to Hong Kong with a fact-finding mission from the American Conservative Union, which has been quite active in South Korea, to the peninsula to take stock of what's happening there, which, as we've discussed on many occasions, is quite worrying under the presidency of Moon Jae-in in South Korea. The president, Donald Trump, met with President Moon yesterday. You've written about all of this in Losing South Korea, but give us a sense of both what, if anything, came out of the meetings yesterday, and what you expect to see on the ground when you're in South Korea next week?
Yeah, We are going to Seoul with the American Conservative Union to participate in the Korean version of CPAC. That will be on October 3. October 3 is also an important day because there'll be a big flag rally in the morning. CPAC will be in the afternoon. And this will be another demonstration of popular opposition to Moon Jae-in, who is very pro-North Korea, pro-China, anti-America. President Trump met President Moon on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly yesterday, as you point out. And there were a lot of measures, topics that I'm sure were discussed. At the top of them would be South Korea's deteriorating relations with Japan, another of our allies. That does weaken our ability to defend both of them. And so I think that that probably was the most important topic, as well as probably they discussed the cost sharing for American forces in South Korea. But we've got so many different issues right now with Moon that I'm sure it was a very full agenda.
Well, I hope so. I hope it was, as they say in diplomatic parlance, a frank exchange of views that the president gave him an earful about concerns about not only what Moon seems to be doing quite purposefully to deteriorate relations with Japan, but also the kinds of steps that he's taking to have a rapprochement with the North, if not actual unification, on Kim Jong-un's terms, which is astonishing. And I imagine you'll get a lot of conversations about that problem, that concern, in the Conservative Political Action Conference in South Korea, Gordon Chang. And I hope that it will inform further, diminution of the popular support for Moon Jae-in and set the stage for next year's National Assembly elections, with which I hope we will see considerable resistance to this agenda at our expense, at the expense of Japan and I think Western interests more generally in the region. We have to leave it at that, my friend. Thank you so much for your time, Gordon. As always, it's indispensable to our understanding of this incredibly important and highly dynamic region. Keep up the good work, my friend. Travel safe, and we'll talk with you next week. Next up, we will speak with Kevin Freeman about developments on the China portfolio, among other things, in the economic warfare arena, right after this.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined by Claudia Rosette, one of the great investigative journalists of our time, celebrated by her peers for her intrepid reporting as well as her courage in speaking truth to power, which is something she has done often in the company of the Wall Street Journal, for whom she reported and served as an editorialist both in Hong Kong and in New York. She's also long time in Moscow in the course of her very distinguished career. These days, she is a foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum and a columnist for PJ Media, where she writes the Rosette Report. We have caught up with her in Hong Kong, about which we were speaking a moment ago with Gordon Chang. We're going to get the on-the-ground, real-time appreciation of what's happening there and what might come next from one of our great resources, Claudia Rosette. Welcome back, Claudia. It's so good to have you. Thank you for taking a few minutes during your time over there.
Yeah, thank you, Frank. Pleasure talking with you.
So give us your sense of the lay of the land, Claudia. Gordon was there a week or so ago and has given us sort of his appreciation. But what is the state of the protest movement at the moment? And what has the government of Beijing, and for that matter, its puppets in Hong Kong done to date in response specifically to the protesters' demands?
Well, the protests continue, and there have been protests of many kinds. There have been these enormous peaceful marches. There have been small peaceful protests. There have been protests that turn violent. Those tend to be small. That has been going on for the 16th straight weekend. They had protests this past weekend in which people attacked targets associated with China. You know, you're reading that there's vandalism here. It's not vandalism in the sense of looting. You know, Hong Kong is a place stuffed with high-end merchandise. If people mm-hmm. wanted to start breaking shop windows, it would be, but that's not what they're doing. They're not stealing. What they're doing is they're attacking targets that specifically symbolize China. To that end, for instance, they have turned on the subway system, the MTR, and have been attacking stations and destroying card readers and writing graffiti all over them and so on. Now, why is this continuing? Because the Hong Kong government, which is really a stooge of China, I mean, it's a front for China and a flimsy front at that. It's transparently a front. So transparently at this point, it's farcical, has given them nothing. There's been no compromise. I mean, there's one thing that's happened that was demanded at the very beginning when a million people marched through the streets, and that was that this proposed law, introduced by their chief executive, a woman named Carrie Lam, who was appointed, effectively picked for her job by Beijing in a rigged so-called election. She introduced this law that would have allowed China to extradite people from Hong Kong for crimes that China considered they had committed. Now, in China, it can be a crime to say insult Xi Jinping, to say something that goes against the party. So this would be a complete breach of the freedoms that Hong Kong was guaranteed by China for 50 years after the 1997 handover. That proposed law, Carrie Lam, the chief executive, after huge demonstrations in June, the early half of June, said she was suspending, but she did not withdraw the bill. And people went on protesting, and their demands grew to the real point, which was they want free elections. They want to choose their own leadership. They don't want a stooge of Beijing who will do things like try and destroy their system with a bill like that. And they have five demands. One was withdraw the bill. Carrie Lam finally agreed to do that in early September. But the other four are really quite significant. And what they all boil down to is people in Hong Kong who are richly ready for real democracy, they understand how it works. They are responsible people who really are, they know the world, they get it. They want real elections. They were promised that by China, and everything has been going in the wrong direction. And since the announcement that basically that proposed extradition law would not happen, in other words, a law that should never have been introduced in the first place was then sort of finally, after months of protest, withdrawn, the government has given them nothing, just nothing. China had been encroaching on Hong Kong's freedoms for years already in significant ways. None of that has been repealed. Instead, what we're seeing now is a cloud of Beijing propaganda.
Right. And the propaganda is obviously designed to discredit the protesters and to suggest that they're destroying Hong Kong and to create ultimately the pretext for presumably a violent crackdown. In my conversation with Gordon Chang, I think he agreed, and I'd be interested in your thoughts, that this is almost certainly going to await the anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China on October 1st of this year. Claudia, but what comes next as you see it?
Yeah, they were putting up red bunting for this around town today. I'm curious to see if it will still be there tomorrow, because a lot happens in the streets here at night right now.
Yeah, especially, as you say, opposing China and its symbols.
Well, people tear it down. I mean, let me give you a quick example of just how farcical the whole scene is. The chief executive, Carrie Lam, has now said she will hold a dialogue platform to hear what people think, you know, to try and fathom. I think that was the actual verb, fathom, the social discontent. Well, it's not hard to fathom. People here have been writing it all over the walls for 4 months.
Yes, not exactly a closely held secret.
Yeah, exactly. It's not subtle. You know, they're very clear what they want. So this isn't a great mystery, but to the end of fathoming the problem, Carrie Lam is going to hold a sort of town hall in a local stadium. And for this, 100 people are invited to apply to be in the audience. They're going to select by lottery 150 people with whom she will then have some kind of exchange. The problem is, apart from the fact that it's a rather absurd approach to begin with, I mean, it's obvious what people want. The people who want to be part of this have to submit their personal data to the government to apply for a slot. Now, remember, in Hong Kong, people are being fired for publicly supporting the protest movement. Cathay Pacific, the flagship airline, has had the heads roll from the CEO down to the fired pilot who said something in a rather cheerful announcement to his passengers, said, don't be worried about the protesters at the airport. They're worth listening to. And then added the slogan that Hong Kong Cantonese, Gaiyao, add oil, means keep going for Hong Kong. He lost his job. So people are supposed to submit their personal details and come speak their minds to the chief executive. This is going to be a very interesting self-selected group, even after the together with the lottery calling. That's the kind of sham exercise that's going on. And China just wants this to all look bright and pretty and full of flags. They've canceled the fireworks for Hong Kong, which people are really quite okay with.
Claudia, let's just turn quickly on the understanding that the people of Hong Kong are in the right here. They are losing their freedom inexorably. The Chinese will presumably, all other things being equal, finish the job off at will after the first. What could the United States do that it hasn't done to date? And specifically, how can we get the Chinese government's attention in this very, very delicate moment?
Well, first, understand that this is not just Hong Kong's fight or problem. That China has these aspirations to be the dominant world power. And I'd be fine with that if it were a democratic China, but it isn't. It's becoming more repressive under Xi Jinping. We're talking totalitarian China. You don't want a dominant world power that is a totalitarian state. That's a bad thing. So it's our problem, too. And I think any form of pressure, there's all this talk about the Hong Kong Freedom and Democracy Act, which would take away Hong Kong's special trading status, basically taking away China's portal to foreign exchange markets, you know, the sort of convenient and banking, the convenient window that it has used. That would hurt Hong Kong, but many of the protesters are saying, please do it anyway. It's worth it for them if it hurts China. I think there are other things more direct that the U.S. should possibly do, ranging, and the biggest thing, Frank, is basically military deterrence is what's needed here.
Claudia, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for your reporting from Hong Kong, and come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.